Welcome to the Chris Wallace Chronicles.
This first episode of Close But No Cigar is set in New York. It was the early 70s. I was married to a Parisienne at the time. She had some friends who had an invention they were trying to get into the U.S. It was at a time when automobile emissions were at their worst, and there were a lot of people in high places who wanted to find a way to clean up the atmosphere. Catalytic converters were one answer to that problem. You can check my science on this, but I think they could be added to a car's engine without too much trouble and thereby mitigate the amount of crap and crud that was polluting the air. Inventors from all over the globe were onto that one. There was a fortune in it. Cookie, as I called her, must have told these friends that I might be able to help since I had a few political connections. In one of the episodes of Applesauce titled Belafonte Enterprises, I mentioned that I worked with Bob Clampett at Referendum 70. Clampett had organized New York artists to contribute a piece of art to Referendum 70, which could be used to raise funds. These funds would then be turned into services for candidates running against the Vietnam War. The artists included Frank Stella, Raphael Sawyer, Saul Steinberg, and some others. I supplied Referendum 70 services. I created political pamphlets and radio and TV ads for various candidates around the country. I already told this, but it bears repeating that one of the candidates I met was Jerry Springer. He was 20-something and running for the House of Representatives from Cincinnati. There were a couple of other candidates from Ohio and one I remember from West Virginia that I did brochures for. I supplied the copy and my buddy Sid did the graphic design. None of the Ohio guys got elected, or the one from West Virginia, but there were two candidates in Baltimore that did. One was Perrin Mitchell, who went on to become one of the founding members of the Congressional Black Caucus. The other was Paul Sarbanes, who sat on the Watergate committee that brought impeachment charges against Nixon. Paul went on to be elected senator from Maryland and distinguished himself there as well. Okay, with that as background, Cookie's friends sent her the specs for the catalytic converter. We had no deal on paper, but Cookie was sure we'd be handsomely compensated, like a royalty of some kind. I had an army buddy, Jim, who was now working for Cummins Engineering in Indiana, a huge international company. I called Jim and told him about the device the Frenchman had. He said to send him the specs, and he'd have them evaluated by the guys at Cummins. Jim got back to me with a thumbs up. With that information, I decided to see what I could do in Washington. So I called Paul Sarbanes' office. Okay, before I get into that, I've got to describe my first meeting with him when he ran for Congress. Actually, he was running for the Democratic nomination, but whoever got the nomination was a shoo-in for the job. His district was very dark blue. And let me quickly add that I had never been involved in any politics until Referendum 70. None. I'm not even sure I voted. But Clampett sold me to these campaigns as one of the best pamphleteers he'd ever known, not to mention my political savvy. The way he'd schmooze those guys, he almost convinced me, too. One day he told me that these two candidates from Baltimore wanted to meet with a representative from Referendum 70. There were two people in our office, Clampett and me. He said, "I can't go, so you'll have to." "What are you talking about?" I said. "I don't know anything about running a campaign or any of that stuff. I just write these brochures." He gave me one of those don't be stupid looks and said, "They don't know that," as if that made it okay. So I hauled myself down to Baltimore. Paul Sarbanes invited me to his house for a breakfast meeting. When I got there, there were already a couple of guys sitting with Paul at the dining room table. His wife, Christina, asked me how I wanted my eggs, and the meeting began. I only remember one of the other guys at the table, Ben Civiletti. This is obviously long before he became President Carter's Attorney General, but it represented the level of their political sophistication. They all talked like Clampett talked to his buddies on the phone, quoting statistics, opinion polls, and all kinds of media stuff. Facts and opinions flew around that room so fast my head was spinning. Then, out of nowhere, Paul asked me what I thought about something. I started tap dancing, trying to remember some of the things that Clampett had said at different times. I couldn't believe it when they all started nodding their heads as if I'd said something profound. I swear to God, I felt like I was sitting in a smoke-filled room at Tammany Hall. It was just like a scene from the musical Fiorello, except nobody was singing. Just me, dancing. Then Paul asked me what I had for them. I pulled out some ideas I'd used on other campaigns. I remember this phrase, rather than focusing on obsolete missiles, we should be focusing on absolute necessities. I like the way it sounded. That reminded Paul of an exchange he'd had in the Maryland legislature with Spiro Agnew, Nixon's original vice president, before he was forced to resign. They were discussing some issue, and Agnew said something like, "We've been listening to all these sarbanalities, etc., etc." And when Paul got the floor, he said something like, "We've had enough of this agnosticism." Obviously, Paul liked wordplay. Then we got back to business. He suggested a couple of changes in the copy I'd prepared and then proclaimed me a genius. They all shook my hand and slapped me on the back, and I walked out of there feeling like Boss Tweed. The meeting with Perrin Mitchell was a little different. It was just him and me. I told him what I had in mind for a TV spot, and he gave it the thumbs up. Must have worked. I promise I'll get back to the invention in a minute, but since I'm on a political roll, I want to tell this story. After Referendum 70, I was well and truly bitten by the political bug. Clampett brought me with him to meet Ken Oletta, who was running Howard Samuel's campaign for the Democratic nomination for governor of New York. He was running against Hugh Carey. Clampett must have sold me pretty well because Ken brought me right into the campaign as a media specialist, and I sat in on most meetings. These guys would throw around statistics and profiles and polling data and yell at each other and pound on the table like this was the most important election in American history. They said that Howard Samuels is getting screwed by Hugh Carey's brother, who owns an oil refinery. They're saying that the refinery money is dirty because it's polluting both the environment and the atmosphere of the political race. They're calling Carey every kind of crook you can imagine and claiming that New York State will shrivel up and die under him. Both of these campaigns are in the same political party, mind you. They're both running for the same party's nomination. But you'd have thought they were mortal enemies by the way these guys attacked the other side in these closed meetings. Finally, someone says we need a last-minute, hard-hitting newspaper ad that will show voters where the opponent really stands. I got the assignment. I called Sid and told him the brief. We came up with an ad that ran in the New York Times. Goebbels would have loved it. It was stark, bold, black and white, and jumped off the page. Carey's campaign had a catchphrase that said, "We can do better." Our ad said, "We can't do worse," and proceeded to call Carey a liar on 6 TV screens stacked one on top of the other, each stating his position as laid out in his TV ad, and then refuting it with a fact. It was masterful in its own way, if I do say so myself, but not something you'd be very proud of, unless, of course, you're a Nazi. The day that ad came out, the shit hit the fan at Samuel's headquarters. Our guys cringed. One of the senior staffers called me into his office. He wanted to know if anyone approved that ad. I told him that everyone had. I told him that because Clampett had told me everyone had. But everyone hadn't. This senior staffer said Carey's campaign had called him to cry foul and that the ad hit below the belt. I asked him if the information was accurate. He said that wasn't the point. Samuels lost the primary, and Carey went on to be elected governor. Almost everyone on Samuels' senior staff went to work for Carey after the primary results were in, like a bunch of camp followers. That's politics. Okay, fade out, fade in. I'm at Paul Sarbanes' congressional office on Capitol Hill. He had invited me to have lunch with him in the House dining room. He introduced me to a number of his colleagues, and we talked politics. Back at his office, I told him about the French guy's invention. I had no idea about lobbying or influence peddling or really how things worked. Paul listened and wished me luck. I didn't ask him for anything. I guess I thought that one day he might be talking to somebody about air pollution and say, "Oh, by the way, I've got this friend in New York who knows some guys from Paris that..." Well, you get the idea. Like I said, I didn't have a clue about how things worked. I was about to leave Paul's office when I remembered something. Again, a little background. When I worked at Channel 5 in New York, there was a PA on the midday show named Sheila. She was peppy and smart and fun, and we became friends. After we both left Channel 5, we lost contact. Some time passed. Nixon was gone by now. His second vice president, Gerald Ford, was now president, and somehow I found out that Sheila had become Betty Ford's press secretary. I sent her a congratulatory note, and she sent me a note back thanking me and saying that if I found myself in Washington, give her a call and pop by the White House. So I'm about to leave Paul Sarbanes' office, knowing that I can take the Eastern Shuttle back to New York whenever I want, and I remember Sheila's offer. So I asked Paul if I can use the phone. One of his assistants asked me what number I want. I said, the White House. They all looked at me like they weren't sure what I said. The White House? Yeah. She dialed the number and handed me the phone. I identified myself and asked for Sheila. She got on the line and said, come on over. I'll give them your name at the gate. Today, the White House is a fortress. Security is virtually impenetrable. I say virtually because you never know what people are capable of, but so far so good. I get to the White House gate, step out of the taxi, and give the guard my name. I don't remember having to show any ID. He points me toward a little porch, so I walk up the driveway onto this little porch. I didn't know what else to do. I was about to knock on the door when it was opened by a Marine who greeted me by name. And just like that, I was in the White House. The White House. The Marine pointed me toward some stairs and said Sheila's office is on the second floor. A woman there told me to have a seat, and in a couple of minutes, Sheila came out of her office and gave me a big smile and a hug. We chatted for a couple of minutes, then she said she was pretty busy, but one of her assistants could take me on a tour of the place. Now, I'm sure there's some deep-seated psychological reasons that could be plumbed to explain my actions. But what I said was, nah, that's okay, you're probably all busy, and turned down her offer to tour the White House with someone who worked there. Unlike Edith Piaf, I do have one huge, enormous, galactic regret in my life, and that's it. How fucking stupid. I seem to have gotten away from the catalytic converter, but I had to tell that story, if only to show... Well, I don't know what it shows. All I know is instead of taking advantage of Sheila's offer and having the experience of a lifetime, I went false humility on her or something and missed it entirely. I repeat, what a fucking idiot. And by the way, to show my efforts weren't entirely in vain, catalytic converters were introduced to American cars within a year or so after my visit to Paul Sarbanes' office. Unfortunately, not the one the French guys gave me. Close, but no cigar. I'm Chris Wallace.